All right, so the reason that I want you to have this and work all the way through is you should, I think, have this in front of you as you're making the dozens, hundreds, thousands of decisions we're going to talk about when you're designing a course. The whole idea here is to give you some focus because you are the focus of your course. There's a book, and there's lectures, and there's tests, but you, in my opinion, need to be the focus of your students in your course. You are trying to take them from one place to another. And if they didn't need you, we would teach another way. Okay? I have taken and taught online courses. I have taken and taught courses using 8-track tapes, for heaven's sakes. And I really prefer being taught and teaching people. And so in that situation, you are the centerpiece. And so you need to know what you're working towards and what you're working away from. And that's what these lists are for. What do you got?
I want the... Well, everyone else really agrees.
That's okay.
But
you're only allowed to.
I want the slides to be also aesthetically pleasing.
Okay.
So, I mean, obviously being prepared and lecturing about graphs and figures and pictures and not just reading off slides, which I think everyone really strives for. And I don't want them to feel like I didn't prepare for the class so that... I mean, I have stuff on the slides, but I don't really know what I'm saying until like 10 minutes later I figure it out. So I want them to feel like that I can add information that's in addition to what's on the slides.
Excellent. Who's left?
Maybe Diane.
Yeah.
But my stuff's already been said.
That's okay.
Basically,
add
I just
your voice.
Want them to say that the concepts were made easy and that they understood it.
Good.
And that it was engaging, and not that it was so convoluted and over their head that then they were more confused about the topic before we started talking about it, or that things were hard to follow or confusing.
Cool.
So I want them to say that the concepts and the main points are explained in a clear and straightforward way that they could understand well. Even the textbook can be hard to understand.
It's true.
And what I don't want them to say is the lecture is not organized.
Okay. You will discover that the more you think about teaching, the more autobiographical teaching becomes. And that's a great place to get started, but you have to be careful. Because one of the underlying principles is they're not you. Okay? The kids sitting in front of you are not you. Let's go all the way here. They're not as bright as you are. They're not as experienced as you are. As a person and within the subject matter. They are not as emotionally invested as you are. They are not you on any dimension you can name, except you might all call yourselves psychologists or educators or some capitalized word. But they are not you. So, you have to do things for them that you wouldn't have to do for you. Am I making sense? Okay. Another important part of this is what you like might not be what they like. And what works for you might not be what works for them. In two ways. One, there's more kinds of them than there are you. And none of them are you. So you can't just say to yourself, I really liked it when my teacher did this. That may or may not be a service to those folks. Does that make sense? They're not you. Intellectually, emotionally, experientially. And there's several kinds of them. None of which are you. So you can always start with, what did I like? What did I not like? What worked for me? When did I finally get it? But you have to teach to everybody that's in the classroom. by the way, the two things that I want people to say about my lectures are is that they're fun and worthwhile. If I can get a belly laugh out of the group every lecture, it's a good lecture. And if it's worthwhile, if it's fun and it's worthwhile, they're going to come back. And this is going to sound like a phys ed teacher. If it's fun, you come back. If you come back, you get better. I believe that my lectures are better than my PowerPoints because there's more to it than the lecture. And so I believe that I want people in the room listening to the lecture, not just reading the book and reading the PowerPoint. Okay? And so I think that if they say to themselves, that didn't suck, or I got something out of that, that maximizes the chances they're going to come back. Things I don't want said are, I don't know why I should care about this. And I have no idea what I just heard. So those are mine. Those don't have to be yours. And they're not mine all the time. They're just sort of the ones that I think of most. So what about other teachers? Now this is a strange question. Because you're unlikely to ever have another teacher really hear your lecture. Right? Now, I can tell you that it's fun. Not so much now, but when I first got here, I usually had two or three faculty members sitting in almost every class I taught because we were teaching models that they hadn't had in graduate school. And I got a lot of interesting, and I'm going to use the word interesting, feedback from people who were teaching and who were, you know, veteran teachers. And they're like, have you ever watched yourself teach? Yeah. Do you take anything seriously? Yeah, lots of things. Yeah, okay. Are you learning stuff? Yeah. Is it making sense? Yeah. Are you having fun? Guilty look. Yeah, okay, it's working. But, so, you've all written shit down, but think for a second, where are they going to get the impressions that you want them to have positively and not have negatively? Who's going to carry that information to them? The other students. Which means that part of the opinion you're trying to build into your students is what they carry to the teachers, when the students and the teachers probably don't care about the same thing. Suddenly get a little more interesting? Okay. So, what are things that you want teachers to say about you and not say about you? You can go nearly backwards.
Sure. That the concepts were covered in their entirety and it wasn't...
That's good.
That it wasn't oversimplified or...
Yes.
That what was taught was applicable and that they wouldn't say that it was completely irrelevant.
Excellent. Who else? The ad kid.
Were you able to get many of the students to engage or participate in class discussions or ask questions?
Okay.
And then something I don't want them to say is that students don't actually gain any knowledge from the course. They just repeat textbooks or definitions.
Excellent. Good.
So I was thinking...
Eye contact is volunteerism.
I was thinking that...
Not looking up is volunteerism.
That if I'm thinking about teachers that will be either teaching either advanced or, you know, or I'm teaching an advanced.
Uh-huh. Excellent.
So I'm saying I can rely on the fact that if students didn't understand it from me, they will understand it from her.
Yep, I love it. You guys have caught the theme. I'm not going to have to beat the theme into you. Keep going. Yeah.
What about like something like the crossover talk between classes? You know, like preparing students to be able to use material with a lot of the other basic classes that you know you're going to take a developmental class or whatnot. So making those drawing those strings together.
Excellent. Give me a knot. No.
Oh, a knot. So.
Oh, as a, yeah, as a metaphor, tremendous metaphor. That's right. Yeah, that's what I meant all along. Hey, Kim.
Do
didn't engage with, you know, implementing ideas across disciplines within the psychology department.
Excellent. Go ahead.
So the not, I mean, it's kind of what everybody else said.
Keep going.
Her students didn't actually learn anything. Plug each other.
Uh-huh.
And then things I want to hear is, like, I wish I would have thought to teach it that way.
Oh, that's tasty. That's ballsy. I like that. Who's left?
One thing I want them to say is that the instruction is prepared, well prepared.
Okay.
Creative in ways to explain things that students from different backgrounds can understand well.
Okay.
What I don't want them to say is that students seem to be confused and don't understand the lecture well.
Excellent.
I kind of have cover the topic to satisfactory depth. You don't go too far broad or too much into the minutia, and then my actual don'ts is that they actually have to reteach what I taught because I didn't teach it well enough and the students don't know anything.
Cool.
Is the satisfactory, like, can we basically say that what we're doing is trying to give them a skill set that they can use in all, you know,
and that's the stuff we were talking about, is we're going to teach more than content. Yeah. Okay, so my two are that I want them to say about me is they did my job for me and they got the kids ready for me to do my job. Those are the classes that follow yours. Mm-hmm. And what I want to hear the intro teachers saying is they cleaned up the stuff that I'm never able to teach as well as I want. You actually hit both of them. The impolite version is they did my job for me. The polite version is they were able to reinforce the things that were important coming out of my class, and they got the kids ready for me to teach my stuff that follows them. And that's what I think of as fulfilling the curricular role of a class. A research methods class usually happens somewhere in between intro and the content courses. You really want them to learn the content and where the content came from. And so if you're in that intermediate, you are cleaning up a bunch of stuff. I mean, really, what they get from methods and stats in an intro book, the intro books are fine. Light, but fine. But they jumble it around in their heads, they get it mixed up with other stuff, and they show up at your door, and 1 and 1 is any number between 0 and 9. So, the things I don't want them to say about me, the other is, I want them to say, I don't dare let him lecture for me. That's totally arrogant. But that's always been a goal, that if I'm teaching a course, a content course or a methods course, that other people don't let me near their kids. Because I'm going to walk in there and I'm going to do a show and they are just not going to hold up. I'm a little competitive. What I don't want them to say is that he doesn't work hard enough. Especially when you're a young teacher, being successful is not enough. They have to see the sweat on your brow. You've got to create those impressions. And another one I don't want them to say is, I don't know what he's doing. Because again, it's a research methods course. I want them to know that I know what they need, and I'm busting my ass to give it to them. Does that make sense? Remember, all of this is under the rubric of impression management. We are trying to create an impression in our students, in our peers, and the people who are evaluating us. Not nudge it around the corners, not spruce it up a little bit, create it from scratch and maintain it. This is where the years I spent with grifters and con men come out. You have got to create. You cannot trust other people to get it right. And no matter where you're going, you're going to have an opportunity to teach, even in business. I probably teach as much when I'm consulting places as I do standing in front of a classroom. It's different, but it's the same. All right, so what about...
Cal, can I ask you a question before...
Yeah, always.
So in the classes that I...
But let me tell you, I promise to not tell you anything.
Okay,
and most of it I will confess to long before you get a chance to think of it to ask me. But I'll tell you anything.
Okay. So in some of the lectures that I've given, I mean, preparing for the class, there's just some concept I just don't understand. I mean, it's not...
Right.
And I'm assuming at some point that may go away, but... And
the list gets shorter, but damn, it never goes away, because they keep coming up with new stuff.
Yeah. So undergrads, obviously when we're teaching them as grad students, like, they're not dumb. They know that we're not as advanced as a faculty member. So one thing I've struggled with is, you know, not oversimplifying information that I'm clearly not an expert on. But at the same time, I don't want to just, like, throw text from a book on the slide and just read it off. And,
right.
I mean, because they know that you don't understand. You're just saying what the book said. And I guess what I found is if you err on the side of that, providing that information you don't really understand, then they're not going to be motivated to learn it because you don't understand it either. So I guess I'd like your opinion on how you bridge that information that you may not be an expert on, but you don't want them to completely not be exposed to it.
Right.
But also not oversimplifying concepts that you just don't have the background knowledge to really provide a full picture of that.
Blatant, unabashed honesty. Especially when you're teaching intro. I mean, the first part of every lecture was I told them whether this is something I liked, whether this is something I cared about, whether this is something that I understood, and what we had to start with, which was what I knew. And, you know, this is the cognitive class. I know this stuff. I'm a cognitive graduate student. But within it, there's some stuff I care about more than others. And so this is the stuff that I want to spend time talking to you about. And this is the stuff that I want you to go read. Because I'm going to spend my time on the stuff that I can do you the most good talking to you about. Now, meanwhile, I'm reading my ass off on that stuff so that when they come to me with questions from the reading. But that's another place that practice can be really helpful. The pink things. Those pink things make every lecture I give better. You know what I mean by the pink things, all those damn exercises? Okay? They make every lecture I do better because, one, they know they're coming. They know they kind of suck. They know there isn't going to be anything new or mysterious on them. People pay more attention in class when there's pink things than when there's not. Across lectures, within subjects, within lectures, and across classes. So... What you're struggling with, what it sounds to me you're struggling with, is two things. One, your responsibilities, and also your capacities. And sometimes those don't seem to match. So what you want to try and do is set up a system where they are getting exposure and practice that is not dependent on you. Almost as if that would be good enough. And then you do what you can do best, which is frankly what you know, and will change over time. Every time you teach a course, it should suck compared to the next time you teach it. And sorry, but that's the way it goes. It's like nobody wants to be in a control group. Right? Nobody wants to get the young teacher. So what do you have that some old fart doesn't have? What can you give your kids that isn't 90% knowledge of the topics in the course that some old fart has? So we talked about being honest, but then what's the replacement for the shit you don't know? What are you going to do?
Fill it in with the stuff that you do know, and then possibly, you know, have a bank of things. Like, you let the students also help teach you. Like, if you started to hear the same kinds of questions about a material that you don't know, then that might be a good
better learn that shit, huh? Yes. Yeah. Listen, graduate pro-sems are the greatest example of this. But the faculty do it so well, they have completely gotten away with it for decades. if I'm teaching a course in my content area, I don't know that whole core. I don't know that whole ProSim. I don't even know that whole book well enough to teach it at the graduate level. So what do? You teach the stuff you like, you know well, and you have projects and presentations and stuff. Right? Do you ever notice that the sections that the professors teach are the sections that they do their research or practice on? Do you think they're doing it because they don't care about anything else? No, they're doing it because that's where they look good. And they should. Okay? So, be honest and use your youth and your enthusiasm. They're not you, but you are closer to them than I am. And this is where autobiographical teaching can be really important. We're going to talk about it in the cognitive domain. But one thing you can do is shape what they care about. You with me? And that is at least as important as getting all the definitions right, in my opinion. I'm going to stop saying in my opinion, because obviously since I'm the one who's saying it.
We've all had those students who are like, well, my last teacher said da 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 da, and they hold on to that like, oh.
Yes. But you have the same problem with young teachers. I learned it this way. I don't even know that the world has changed since I learned it. Same thing with old farts. All right. So, people who are going to evaluate you. Yeah. me. God bless you.
Could you please be the presenter at our visiting program in Buford and Paris next summer?
Yeah. Yeah. What do you not want her to say?
Your evaluation last semester indicated that your lectures are being not at all useful for students. Maybe you need to teach something simpler.
Cool. Who else? Come on. What do you want people said who have your reins in their hands? Yeah.
That your lectures are a good reference for future iterations of the course.
Nice.
And then bad, your lectures and by proxy your entire course is a dead end. Your students go in there and they don't actually like do anything different.
Good. What else? Gab?
Something I want them to say is able to balance a difficult or rigorous course with still getting good teaching evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And then not to say the lectures frame the discipline in a negative light, boring or easy, and so attract students who don't want to work harder, think critically.
Cool. Who else?
I want them to say that it was relevant and consistent with, well, so I get asked to do a lot of teaching. Mm-hmm. So for people that ask me to do that, I want them to say that it was consistent with what they had asked me to come talk about.
That's good.
And I never want them to say that it was a waste of people's time and that they would never invite me back.
Tasty. I like it. Jump in.
I would hope they would never say that I was replaceable.
There's a problem with not being replaceable. If you can't be replaced, you can't be promoted, is an old expression within business. If you can't be replaced, you probably can't be adequately substituted for, and you never get to do anything else or take sabbatical. My solution to that is I freaking hate sabbaticals. I've been required, I have put them off as long as I could each time. Apparently there's a bylaw and eventually, but it's a nightmare to miss a semester when you teach a year-long course. Then I don't want anybody teaching that course. Yeah.
Well, assuming that I'm a faculty member one day, I don't want them to say that I could be replaced by a grad student or a TA.
Okay.
And then something that I would want them to say is that the content is accurate and up to date.
Okay. What do you got?
Something I want them to say, like, she really got serious connected with her students.
Mm-hmm.
And something I don't want them to say is she does the minimum amount of work required.
Excellent.
And
What you got?
What I want them to say is that she's a role model teaching this course.
Oh, that's tasty. I love it.
What I don't want them to say is that the lecture style should be more interactive.
Okay.
I would like them to say that we would like her to teach how to teach at this class.
Okay. You stole mine. Which means I like it. Yeah, the thing I once said is, I want this person teaching our teachers. The other thing I once said is, I don't know how they get that much done. I don't know how they get that much covered. The thing I don't want them to say is, I don't think they care about their kids. All right. So, what I would like you to do between now and Thursday is finish this up. I'm going to take some time on Thursday and talk through the others, because you're going to change your mind about these things. You might even have things flip from want to say to don't want to say, or back and forth as you mature as a teacher. I can remember that I had a workshop with a kid who now teaches in this department. And what they said was, I don't want them to say that they know what's on the test. I want them to not feel like they don't know what's on the test and they have to cover everything. Now that person would never make that statement. They're a huge directed design, backwards design type. They want students spending their time exactly and explicitly on the things that they want them to learn, not... So all sorts of things are possible as you grow up in this business. Do you have any ideas about stuff you might that you want to do? So I can sort of start a list and start looking for things. Okay, let me run you down through a list then. One of the things that I want to talk about and get your opinions, because I don't even know who's had what, but there are two different traditions. There's the separate stats and methods course tradition and the integrated course tradition. The history is, I think, fascinating. And the history seems to repeat itself almost everywhere except Creighton, which has had the same two courses the whole 30 years that I've been here. But most other places have gone through at least two or three cycles during that. So it starts out that they're separate courses. And the people who teach those courses grumble because there seems to be no integration. When they take the stats course and they come to the methods course, they don't remember any stats. If they take the methods course first, they can't tell the IV from a DV when they come to the stats course. It's just, eh. And eventually over time, somebody goes, fuck it, I want to teach both. And then they start teaching them together. And everybody's happy until that person retires. And there's no one who's willing to teach the integrated course. And they split it and pawn it off on two young faculty or two old faculty. There was some research done back in the 90s. And it was replicated about 5 or 6 years ago, frighteningly well, that about 50% of the people who teach methods and stats courses are teaching it because they're too old or too young to avoid it. They don't have enough juice to not teach it. They're stuck with teaching it. These are the people who write the textbooks. Because most of the time, a textbook is written not because someone is desperate to get their knowledge about stats and methodology out, but because they're stuck with this shit and they got a kid heading for college. That's also the most common reason for a second and a third edition of things, is the next kid hits college. That's one thing I want you to start paying attention to. When we talk about that, what did you have? What did you like about it? What did you not like about it? What do you think it ought to be? Stuff like that. So that's one thing that I want to make sure that we talk about. When I got here, we were teaching a research methods course and teaching people to the math department for stats. And, yeah, it was awful. It was awful. Then we went through a period where we encouraged people to take the stats course before they took the integrated course, which we discovered was an incredible waste of time. What people were doing instead was taking 350 first and then taking their stats course and getting A's in it, because they already had had everything that they taught. They just taught it so mathy that nobody could figure out what the hell they were being taught, because we're behavioral scientists. Part of what we do each day is avoid math. And we're good at it. Another thing that I want to talk about is labs. And part of the lab thing is, you know, what are you trying to do in a lab? How much are the lab and the courses repetition? You know, that whole sort of recitation versus laboratory, thinking about how you want to do things. But can you think of stuff that you want to cover?
Yeah. This might be a niche interest, but I'm interested in remote learning, so producing lectures and stuff in video form that people can rewatch and stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, the software is now does all of that. It's amazing. Typically, that software is directly tied to your portal. So we've got stuff that's tied to Blackboard. So yeah, I can't do it. But you push like three buttons and it's recording things and it puts it somewhere. And some of them even generate their own web page that have dates and links. So, well, yes, we will. I can make that worse. What if the number of people in that lecture class is unmanageable for discussion? We start with usually between 165 and 175. Last semester was the first time that we only had 15% that walked. For a while there, we were having as much as 40% of the people were grazing, just grazing. And they had no intention of finishing the course. They would sit around for the first or the second sets of material, not even take the exams, then withdraw. The problem was that the sophomores were listening to the juniors who were afraid of the course instead of the seniors who were kicking its ass and telling people, you should take this as early as possible. Which will lead to a discussion about required courses and course sequencing and stuff like that. But yeah, my solution is the lab. Lectures are shows and stories, and the lab is, you know, people. But that's just what I've sort of gotten backed into, partly because of my numbers and partly because there is nothing that I do more poorly than lead a class discussion. I mean, this kind of thing where people are, you know, this is not what I think of as a class discussion. When I'm trying to, you know, I suck at that. I don't even try anymore. Yeah?
I think balancing the teaching on the actual stats and then how to use the software package.
Yep. Yes. Very often that won't be your decision. Very often there is in the description of the courses, that is sort of decided for you. But very often that was decided by people decades ago when the world was different. And then you spend a few years remaking it in your own image. So yes, we want to talk about what you want that image to be. Because it depends on who you're working with. I mean, who you get and things like that. The people who teach, who have taken big chunks of this course and teach it over in the business college, teach more math stat in 350 than I do. One, their kids are better at math, and two, the stats, the way that things are discussed and sequenced over there, they need more math than we do. So it works out great. It's when there's a mismatch between who you get and what they need and what you're expected to do with them that you run into a crisis. And I cheat. You all had 941. Well, okay, you guys, since you had 941, the last two sections, the last section is now non-parametrics and meta-analysis. Did you have it that way?
I think the meta-analysis
was
that
end, yeah. Okay.
I think it was actually the end of 941.
Yeah, it was. So now at the end of 941, non-parametrics is an opportunity to talk about a bunch of assumption stuff that nobody wants to sit still for when they're first learning about t-tests and correlations and ANOVAs. All of that seems like gatekeeping shit before I get to go to the fun stuff. I want to learn how to do this in SPSS. No, we have to talk about Laplace transformations and shit like that. Nobody wants to do that. But if we do it after you know the models and we say, all right, so how do you decide when to use a parametric model and when to use a non-parametric model? People will sit there and learn from exactly the same slides. It almost makes you crazy. Those same slides as part of the ANOVA lectures, like you put it in as part of the non-parametric slide. So you got to find places. By the time we get to that part of the course, everybody's sick to death of internal and external validity and sampling and selection, but they're more sick to death of it than they're good at it. So I really need one more rep. So by teaching meta-analysis and the idea of coding the designs for what's comparable and what's not comparable, everybody sits there and thinks real hard about internal and external validity and sampling and selection and all that stuff one more time. So part of it is where you put it has a big impact on how much depth and how many reps you can get away with. If you make something obviously part of learning something that they care about, they will tolerate it. Make sense? So that's part of it. Is you can probably teach more of whatever you need to than you think you can just by sequencing, repetitions, and a big load of why they should care. If I teach that same set of seven, it's only seven slides. Maybe it's eight, but there's seven or eight slides that are really good slides for assumptions and why we care. And if I give those as part of the ANOVA lecture versus I give those as part of the non-parametric lecture, there's like a 2-point difference in performance on the essay question. It sort of annoys me, but fuck it. Okay? I can do it this way, and my kids learn. And they learn the stuff that they don't value yet. What else? So think of stuff that you want to do. So here's what you should do for tomorrow. You should read the backwards design article. You should read the knowledge and skills article. And you should get working on your wannabe. What we're going to talk about together, two things, and we'll probably be here all of tomorrow. Okay? We want to talk about Bloom's taxonomies, all three of them. The cognitive part is interesting. I want to talk about the changes, some of the changes, and the changes that seem to be coming again. Because the third generation of that is rearing, and it's going to be good. But we're also going to look really carefully at the affective and the psychomotor. Not because we're going to be teaching them to throw soccer balls or softballs or anything, but because we are going to make that distinction between learning about and learning how to. And the elements of how to do a t-test are exactly the same as the elements for how to throw a football. There is a progression. One of the things that we're going to talk about really, really carefully is that every portrayal of Bloom that you get shows it as a hierarchy. Bloom called it a freaking taxonomy. Do you know the difference? A taxonomy sorts things into kinds. A hierarchy then says there is a firm order in the acquisition of those kinds. And while there is some presaging and preparing, I'm going to make the argument that the best way to learn those levels is to revisit them before and after other levels. So we're going to take sort of an episodic approach to working our way through this. The other thing we're going to talk about is this Teaching for Understanding, which was a book that came out, I have to look at the date. It was a long time ago. But it was great because it finally got people to think about how they were going to assess learning. That got them to revisit learning. And this is all about a production approach to assessment and evaluation. Not just asking people to know stuff, but to use it. So not just about, but how to. We're going to add another layer to that, which is the not only knowing how to do it, but being able to articulate how you knew what to do and what you did. Now, when we talked about that in our classes, we talked about that as scripts. So you not only can do it, but you know what it is you're doing and maybe even why you're doing it in that order. You know, little things like why do we cover the interaction first? To set up the proper examination of the main effects. The other thing about the articulation, this is probably just my overly dramatic response to that nasty old phrase, those who can do, those who can't teach. Those who can do. Those who can't die.
It's a little more dramatic.
Those who know what they're doing can teach. Okay? Because think about it. Think about the scant proportion of professional athletes who turn into successful coaches. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you can train the next generation to do it as well as you can. What's the difference? One, knowing what it is you're doing and being able to articulate it. And it's tough because experts lose contact with their expertise. It's so automated, it's so fast, they've done it so many times that when somebody says, how the hell did you do that? They look at you and if they say anything, it sounds like, oh, it's intuition. No, you haven't always known that. You didn't just pull it out of your ass. You have spent a career perfecting this skill. You've just lost contact with both the history and the elements. But as teachers, we have to maintain and often seek out and work real hard to find those elements, to find the progression. And often, that's the stuff that makes the affective sense. Because nobody likes to fail. Right? If I can tell you why you should care about something, and it looks kind of hard, but then you do well on it, I own you. Right? Cognitive dissonance. Load expectancy effect? That's what they used to call it. If you think something's hard, and then you kick its ass, you like it. If you think somebody's unpleasant, but they like you, you like them. If you think for a second there's any job in the world more manipulative than being a teacher, you're wrong by one. There's only one.
Yeah.
What is it?
Hi.
Parenting. So I am going to pretty unabashedly take a parenting and coaching perspective to teaching. And the only way to do this is to start by assuming that you honestly give a shit about the kids. Whether you know the names of the five of them in your lab or whether you can remember five names of the 165 of them out there, you have to honestly give a shit about them and their welfare. Dr. Wyckoff used to say you can love 200 kids at a time without knowing any of their names. And he was phenomenal at it, except he also was really good at names, son of a bitch. Oh, he was one of these guys who would read off the roster and call people by name when he saw them on campus. He not only recognized them and their name, but he could do it out of context. I can usually tell my children no matter which room they're in the house. I'm getting better. All right. So a lot of stage setting, especially on the affective side, on the selling side, on the motivational management, having our will sides. So go do some reading and continue to think about what you want to do on Thursday. Because I want to do what you guys want to do. Because every class almost always ends up covering about the same stuff. But if there's an optimal order based on stuff that you want to do, let's play.